because he's right after you. But our next speaker really needs no introduction. What can I say? But he's a distinguished professor at City University of New York, Hunter College. He's also the director of Center for HIV Education, Studies, and Training, also known as CHEST. He is really a prolific figure in the history of HIV research since the early days, even though he was only about five when he started, right? When he got his first grant. He's also responsible for the career development and social development, I think, of an entire generation of people working within the HIV/AIDS world. So give him a round of applause. He's Jeff Parsons.
Well, thank you. That was so unlike the brief bio description I entered into the system that was theoretically going to introduce me. But I like yours better. So, hi, good afternoon. So, it's sort of ideal timing that Brian led with really sort of looking at some of the developmental issues, particularly around sort of what happens as young gay men transition into the sort of emerging adulthood phase. I'm going to focus sort of exclusively on that, and I have nothing to disclose. So I'm going to present data from the Young Men's Health Project, which was a National Institute of Drug Abuse funded RCT of an intervention aimed at reducing both sexual risk and substance use among young gay and bisexual men in New York City. And it takes a huge team of fantastic folks to carry out a study like this. Some of them are in the room, particularly Karina Weinberger, who was the project director and research scientist who really led the project. But it's a whole other host of folks were actively involved in carrying out this five-year study. So to give you a little bit of sort of reasons for why we're looking at this particular group, when you start to look at the diagnoses of HIV infections among adults and adolescents, you start to see that, of course, the majority of them are in males. This is something that people have known. But a lot of them are among the younger males. And the fact that if you start to look at the year of diagnosis going from 2006 to 2009 and the age group of the people who are newly diagnosed, you see among those who are 55 or older, a fair amount of stability among the 45 to 54-year-old group, a little bit of stability. The 13 to 24-year-old group, you see a huge increase going on. That's really where the sort of increase in infections are happening. And when you sort of tease out that data a little more, it's really not as much the 13, 14-year-old. It's really those who are 17, 18, 19, that sort of, you know, moving into late adolescence or early adulthood. And then I think it's also important to look at the 25 to 34-year-old group, because that group is also showing an increase, unlike the other groups. And again, when you tease out that group, it tends to be the younger end of the 25 to 34 rather than the older end, where you see a huge increase in infections. And even in at the World AIDS Conference here in D.C. just a few months ago this summer, the prevalence rates were found to be fairly stable among 18 to 22-year-old young NSM, but the group that they were really increasing among were those 23 to 29. And so again, it's important that we start to look at this emerging adulthood group because, as the focus of this symposium is on sort of developmental issues, they have some unique things going on that make them quite different from true adolescents or younger folks as well as the adults. So, we do a lot of focus on emerging adults as a group, in part because of the HIV rates, but also just because it's a unique developmental group. This is a group of individuals who have attained an adult status. You know, if you're over the age of 18, you can certainly drive, you can vote, which hopefully they'll all be doing next week, if we can, you know, get through the flood damage to get to polling places and such, and if there's electricity to run them, just dealing with a little post-Sandy bitterness. But the difference and the unique aspect of this group is that although they have the status of being an adult, they often don't have the full range of adult responsibilities, right? They're often doing things like going to college, which is a fantastic thing. Education is great, but it's really a way of delaying adult responsibilities. Graduate school is an even better way of delaying adult responsibilities, right? Because you can stay in graduate school forever. Lots of people just sort of never really want to leave because it's very comfortable. You get your student loan check. You think eventually you get an LRP and pay them off. It won't really be a problem. So, again, it's a unique developmental period because although they have the status of an adult, they're not fully embracing adult responsibilities. Then there are a lot of things that we see going on, particularly among this group of MSM. And things like substance use, which the rates tend to be very high, polydrug use tends to be the norm, and the relationship between use of illicit drugs and sexual risk behavior tends to be incredibly robust, particularly among this group of folks. It's also often a way in which young gay and bisexual men socialize. And it's how they start to develop, and again, the developmental period being critical, it's how they start to develop interpersonal relationships with other gay men. And if those sort of early experiences of, oh, I've got, you know, a new gay best friend, if those experiences are sort of tied to drug use, there are concerns then that that could be sort of continued through the developmental cycle and lead to more problematic substance use or dependence. Mental health is an issue. Certainly the rates of depression and anxiety in this group are much higher, and again, a fairly consistent research findings to show the connection between that and risky sex. And then attitudes towards condoms. A lot of data has shown that if you have positive attitudes about using condoms, you're going to be more likely to use them. And one of the concerns among young gay and bisexual men is this is the period in which they're going to start developing those attitudes. And so we really want to sort of hope that they develop seeing condoms as a positive thing. That is, I'm going to be able to have sex with a condom and not worry, not feel guilty, not be concerned about my safety, and really start to kind of establish positive attitudes about the use of condoms rather than condoms are a pain, they ruin the spontaneity, they're messy, all of that sort of stuff, which could decrease condom use because more negative attitudes are associated with less condom use. And as Brian indicated, there's also a huge focus right now on relationships in HIV. The data that Patrick Sullivan came out with a few years ago showing the majority of new infections in MSM being related to primary partnerships gave, I think, a lot of us in the field pause because we had been focusing so much on sex with casual partners. Some of us had huge data sets where we just took all the data of sex with main partners and put that aside so that we could run sex with casual partners as our outcome. We obviously need to look at that now. And again, young men are sort of entering into primary partnerships for the first time. And we tend to see different patterns among young gay men, particularly serial monogamy or a difference of monogamy, what we call monogamish relationships, where it's like, well, we're going to sort of be monogamous, but sort of not. And all of these types of things come into play. So it's sort of critical to look at all four of these things when you're looking at the relationship with what young gay men are doing around their sexual risk. So we developed this randomized controlled trial. It was a brief four-session risk reduction intervention. It was using motivational interviewing, and it was designed to reduce both drug use and sexual risk. The key was that we were targeting non-treatment-seeking youth. So this was not a study for youth who were like, oh my God, I got a drug problem and I need to fix it. It was more about, you know, come in and talk to somebody about any concerns you might have. It was not really sort of done as a, you've got a problem with drugs, we're going to fix it type of thing. We put a lot of effort into recruitment. It's tough to recruit young gay men into intervention trials. It's tough to recruit them into research studies in general. A lot of folks who do this kind of work know this. So we used sort of everything that we could. We did a lot of advertising campaigns, both internet-based and venue-based. We did a little incentivized snowball sampling, which is what we call respondent-driven sampling when we don't do it using the formal method. We used brochures. We sort of developed a lot of different sort of fancy materials. This was like one of the brochures that we did to sort of give people information about the project. Literally, we spent, three and a half years trying to recruit men and going through so many different ad campaigns. We have a fabulous graphic artist who helps us conceptualize things. And when all was said and done, it was a single image and tagline that got us the majority of participants. Got blow. It worked. It was bizarre, and it still sort of surprises us that we had all of these really creative campaigns around sort of the drug sex thing, and ultimately a line of baby powder and those words. That's what people sort of called in to find out about. So to be eligible, you had to be 18 to 29, a biological male. You had to identify as HIV negative or unknown status. You had to report at least 5 days of drug use in the past 3 months, and the specific drugs that we were focusing on were the club drugs, so cocaine, meth, ketamine, GHB, poppers. And you had to report at least one incident of anal sex without a condom with either a positive or unknown status main partner or any casual partners in the last 3 months. And the reason we did that was, you know, a lot of times people will say, well, if, you know, my casual partner says that they're HIV negative, so therefore they must be. We consider that still a risk partner. Unless you've actually gone and tested with somebody, unless you really have sort of knowledge of that person's status, we didn't like sort of separating out casual partners who told the participant that they were negative from the other potential unknown participants that they might have had, or the unknown casual sex partners that the participants reported. So we included any casual partner as a risk partner. We conducted baseline and then 3, 6, 9, and 12-month follow-ups using ACASI and a 30-day timeline follow-back calendar. And then they didn't have to participate in the intervention. They could just come in and do the assessment study. But a lot of them did elect to be randomized into one of the two arms after baseline. So the analyses I'm going to present draw just on the baseline data from everybody, regardless of whether they ultimately participated in the intervention. And we looked at the independent and interactive effects of sort of all the things that I've talked about, substance use, mental health, the perceived attitudes about condom use and unprotected sex, while looking at the role of relationship and whether the sex was with a main versus a non-main partner. So we looked at substance use on a day of sexual activity from the timeline follow-back. Mental health, we used the BSI anxiety and depression subscales. We had a benefits of unprotected sex scale that we've used in previous studies, and we also looked at the timeline whether it was a main partner sex day. For main partner, we define that as being in a romantic relationship with another man for at least 90 days. And if they had a seroconcordant or unknown status, then they were still in. If they said, I know that my main partner is HIV positive, we excluded them from these analyses because that sort of a known serodiscordant relationship is a little different type of thing. They also had to have had sex with this main partner in the past 90 days to be categorized in this. And so our outcome was odds of not using a condom on a sex day. So did they not use a condom on a day that they had sex? We used generalized estimating equations to assess the relative odds of not using a condom on a day when a participant had sex, adjusting for our predictors. And this is a little demographic breakdown, so you can see that about 35% of the sample was white, and the rest of the sample identified as a racial or ethnic minority. The income was pretty broad. We sort of grouped it into this way. Obviously, living in New York City, even on $30,000, is, you know, difficult. So, but for the most part, these were not hugely wealthy folks. A lot of them had some college at least. 40% had college or more. And 90% of them identified as gay. 10% of them identified as bisexual. And 18% were in a relationship at the time of baseline. So there was a lot of variety in the sex. This shows the percentage of participants who had a no condom sex day and then the mean number of no condom sex days. And so the full sample is over on the left. You see that over 85% of them had a no condom sex day. And then the next two are for the non-partnered men in the middle and the partnered men on the right. And you see it's sort of consistent in terms of the majority of people were reporting non-condom sex days. So the majority of our sample was engaging in sexual risk in general. If they had a main partner, they were doing it with the main partner, and if they had a casual partner, they were doing it with the casual partner. This is the same type of look for the drug use. You see that for the any drugs, over 85% reported any drugs. The reason that that's not 100% is that the eligibility was for the past 90 days, and this is past 30-day data. So there were a small number of folks who met criteria over the past 90, but not in the past 30 days. And on average, for any drugs, they had used any drugs on about 6.5 days in the past 30. And you see, the main drug for this population was cocaine. That was sort of the drug of choice. That's probably why the gut blow recruitment card resonated so well with the sample. But you also see the rates of sort of ecstasy, meth, GHB, and ketamine up there. So this is just the first order odds of not using a condom on a day that drugs were used. And basically what you see is if any drug is used on a sex day, there's about a 2 times the odds that they would not use a condom. And that was significant for the any drug category and all of the other drugs, cocaine, GHB, meth, and ketamine. It was not significant for ecstasy. That was the only drug that did not seem to be related to having a non-condom use sex day. Okay. So here is the graphical representation of the relationship between substance use and BSI scores, condom use, and sex with main versus casual partners. And we also wanted to look at the interaction between total BSI score, which was the anxiety and depression subscales, and sex with main partners. So this is sort of taking the odds from the previous thing and then turning it sort of into graphical representation. And let me sort of take you piece by piece through this. So the distance between the maroon and the blue lines, as well as the distance between the green and the purple lines, is the effect of using drugs on the sex day. And so what this shows is, again, participants who used drugs were 2.17 times as likely to not use a condom than participants who did not use drugs on a sex day, controlling for all of the other variables in the model. And with the purple arrows, the difference between the blue and the green lines, as well as the difference between the maroon and the purple lines, shows the effects of having sex with a main partner on a given day. And so here what we see are that participants who had sex with a main partner were over 4 times as likely to not use a condom than participants who had sex with a casual partner. The blue circle shows the effect of increases in BSI score. And so each standardized increase in total BSI score increases the odds of not using a condom by 1.36 times. Finally, the direction of the slopes with the green arrow shows the effects of our interaction. And so what we see here is the relationship between having sex with a main partner and condom use gets moderated by the BSI scores. And so as BSI scores increase for those who are having a main partner sex day, the odds of not using a condom decrease by a factor of about 7. Which is a considerable decrease. So during a day that they're having sex with a main partner, those who are not depressed or anxious are less likely to use a condom than those who are more depressed or anxious. Happy partnered people are not using condoms with their main partners. Okay? Inversely, the people who have a sex day with casual partners are more likely to use a condom when they're not depressed or anxious. So happy people having sex with casual partners are more likely to use condoms. So if you're happy with a casual partner, you use a condom. If you're not happy with your main partner, you don't use a condom. Okay? So there's something going on with sort of how a person's kind of feeling in terms of mental health and the interaction with their main partner. It's probably having something to do with a level of trust in their main partner. It may be that the people who are a little more depressed and anxious also have a lack of trust in their partner. And so they may be more inclined to want to use a condom because of the concerns that they have. Perhaps they're worried that the partner is doing something else on the side. Or maybe they're doing something on the side and they're feeling some sort of depression and anxiety around that. And so they may actually want to be using a condom to potentially protect the partner if they think they might have gotten something. Okay, so this is sort of doing the same kind of analysis, but specifically looking at the benefits of unsafe sex and sort of what happens there. And so with the red arrows, you see that the drug effect is still there. So drugs continue to have a strong effect on condom use. regardless of sort of what you see as the benefits of unsafe sex or using condoms. With the purple arrows, this is the partner effect, which is also still there. So having sex with the main partner on a given day still significantly increases the odds of not using a condom, and higher benefits of not using condoms are also associated with not using them. But what we see with the green arrow is the slopes are moving in the same direction. So we don't get the same sort of interaction with the main partner versus non-main partner relationship that we saw with anxiety and depression. So basically the sort of moral of the story is if you don't like using condoms, there's a greater odds that you're not going to use them, regardless of whether it's your main partner or it's a casual partner. And this sort of just goes through the specifics of the model. This is, again, the drug effect. Drugs being used on a sex day, you're over twice as likely to not use a condom. This is the main effects of the main partner sex day in terms of that having a strong effect on not using a condom. And the BSI total score had a positive trend of no condom use, but the relationship wasn't statistically significant. But the BSI is associated with condom use when it's moderated by the main partner sex day. And that's what we see there, the BSI by main partner sex day interaction. And that's also the decisional balance or the attitudes, the perceived pros about using condoms still having a strong effect on condom use. So drug use in general, perceiving benefits of sex without a condom in general, were both associated with unprotected sex days, and pretty consistently. The ways in which things sort of got a little different had to do with the BSI scores, which moderated the effects of having a main partner. So the partnered men with low BSI scores, the happy people, increased their odds of not using a condom, which were further exacerbated by their drug use. Inversely, having sex with the main partner and being more depressed and anxious seemed to increase the odds of using a condom. Now, regardless of whether a partner was main or casual, having these perceived benefits of having unprotected sex or negative attitudes about using condoms decreased condom use in general. So obviously substance use is still a big deal. And the fact that it sort of remains a strong predictor of condom non-use, regardless of what else you look at, really suggests that it needs to continue to be a focus of intervention. And there's sort of some of us in our group who almost believe, like, if we intervene just on the drug use, that may be enough to subsequently reduce condom use. And one of the things that we find interesting when we talk to young gay men is they're actually more interested in talking about their drug use than they are in talking about their unsafe sex. So it may actually be a good sort of way to kind of get in and do some intervention work, because they're much more likely to be willing to come and talk to you about their substance use than they are risky sex. And my feeling is if they're willing to come talk to you at all, let's take advantage of that. And so I think we can sort of do kind of the safer sex education almost through the back door, if you'll pardon the pun, by really zeroing in on the substance use aspect. Now, we have to continue to focus on the perceptions and the attitudes about condom use and unsafe sex, because this again is still a really robust predictor over and above substance use. And changing these perceptions that somehow condoms are a negative thing or that unprotected sex is somehow better than protected sex is something that we really need, I think, different approaches to. We need different forms of education. Just sitting down and saying, you know, oh, but using a condom isn't so bad, obviously isn't cutting it. I don't think we've hooked into what are the right messages to give young gay and bisexual men about the benefits of using condoms and the non-benefits of unprotected sex. Obviously, efforts to improve mental health among those who are having sex with casual partners could increase condom use in this group. We need to understand, though, the situation with the main partners and the mental health and sort of what's going on there. And this is from the baseline data, so it's really a snapshot. We don't really have any sort of idea what may be happening over time with this. We want to look at that next. And it just sort of goes, as Brian suggested, to show the need that we have for relationship-oriented work that's longitudinal in nature, ideally maybe with cohorts so that we can follow them for a decent chunk of time. And that's it. Thank you.